inviting me to give the talk. So here's the subject. Suppose you have a manifold of dimension M, and it's just a topological manifold . That means that it has an atlas of coordinate charts, but the overlap between the coordinate charts is just continuous, not smooth, topological manifold. Smoothing problem says, or question asks, when is there a smooth atlas consistent with the topological atlas? When can the manifold be smoothed? Okay, so the theorem due to Cairns and Whitehead is this. Suppose that M is a submanifold of Euclidean space. And suppose that it's got a continuous transverse field of planes. Transverse means the following. Transverse to M, which means this. That for every point P, if you look at the N minus M plane N, and you look at its perpendicular complement, translated so that they pass through the point P, then the manifold looks like a graph near the point P. So locally, this is what M looks like. Is a graph of a Lipschitz function. So it's mapping some small neighborhood of the point P in this plane into the transverse plane. Okay? So that's the definition of what it means to have a transverse field. No. No. It can't be true, as I will. Right. Yes, there are problems with this. But this is the definition. N is a transverse field for M. Continuous field of planes, and locally the manifold looks like a graph of a Lipschitz function. Okay. Now here are some. So this is a true theorem. This was proved by Whitehead in 1961, sort of perfecting some ideas of Cairns in the 30s, maybe 40s. Oh, state the theorem. Good point. Answer is yes under these circumstances. Cairns-Whitehead. Yes, if. Okay, you can smooth it. And, okay, I'm going to discuss it a little bit, and then I'm going to outline a proof using dynamical systems. Well, in a sense, it's a locally unique. One will see that the actual smooth manifold is constructed so that it approximates locally in all of these charts. It approximates the original manifold. And among that sort of smoothing, it is unique. But you could always imagine a smoothing which was completely unrelated to how it was embedded in Euclidean space. Yes, right. In fact, let me make an aside, that was basically the way that Whitehead proved it. He proved it like this. He said, well, you've got all these planes. Since the submanifold in green is only Lipschitz, you can't really speak of the planes varying in a C1 fashion. Right? That doesn't make sense because they're only defined at points of a Lipschitz set. But he had a way to get around that. And he said, well, I will find this family of planes which is transverse and is in some sense C1. Then I will contract, as it were, I will contract those planes to points, and that will be the red manifold. That was kind of his idea. Okay, well, the idea I'm going to, his technique was different than what I'm going to describe. And anyway, so that's an aside. Now, related results. Curvair. There exists a 10-dimensional manifold, compact, topological, not smoothable. In other words, no smooth atlas. Sullivan. If the manifold doesn't have dimension 4, it has a Lipschitz structure. In other words, a Lipschitz atlas. Whitney, given the atlas, any atlas, you can use it to make an embedding. And that will say that locally, the manifold can be embedded in Euclidean space so that it looks like this. There's no contradiction because after this Whitney embedding, which says embed via the atlas and locally have that diagram, the normal plane is not, from the Whitney construction, is not continuous. It'll just exist on a finite family of coordinate neighborhoods which cover the manifold. So there's some subtlety going on here. So this, it looks like that theorem almost contradicts these principles here, but it doesn't quite. Okay, so that's one related bit of information. Another is this. Now, the guy's names, I've not got them memorized correctly. Other people have looked at a similar questions. And their names are Shikata, Weller, and Michael. In various papers. They ask the following related, I think it's related, question. Suppose you've got a Lipschitz atlas. As you do, except in dimension 4. Suppose you've got a Lipschitz atlas. You can look at the chart transfers from one neighborhood to another neighborhood. And you can say, get the best possible Lipschitz atlas. That means that the chart overlap maps have Lipschitz constant as close as possible to 1. if they had the Lipschitz constant equal to 1, all of the chart overlaps, you'd be looking at something essentially flat. Okay? Do as best you can. That's a number that you they think they call the size. Or it should be the size of the atlas, but anyway, they think of it as the size of the manifold. If this is close enough to 1, and close enough has a lot to do with the dimension, unfortunately, but if it's close enough to 1, then the answer is you can smooth it. Okay, so they have various degrees of how accurately they measure this. Okay, what I'm going to show, included in proving this theorem, is the following. Suppose you don't know that n is continuous. But you can cover it by this sort of graph coordinate systems. So again, M is a submanifold of Euclidean space. And this N is transverse, as in this picture here, locally, covered by graph charts such that the Lipschitz constant, let's give a name to this function whose graph is this green thing, graph of the Lipschitz function g, such that the Lipschitz constant of g is less than or equal to 0.18, then yes. Weird. Well, they're both part of Euclidean space. This is a very Euclidean space kind of statement. No. No, not quite. You could state it like that, but actually it's enough to say there's a system of charts which covers the manifold. Let's say the manifold is compact, always, for simplicity. Bunch of charts, covers the manifold. In the charts, it looks like this. To do with the dimension? No. No. It's merely that in each chart, this normal family is okay. In different charts, different normal families. But what this is really saying is that when you go from one chart to the next chart, things are not radically changing. By 0.18, slope might be by differing. Because if you have an overlap of charts, the assumption is that it's got to be slope less than 0.18 in both charts. Yes? This is a picture, a chart for each P, and that's what the Cairns-Whitehead theorem assumes and deals with. Don't know. I don't know. I mean, you can say, assume in addition that the manifold is PL. And the angles are not too bad. Right. Right. So that would be an application. What I would really like, you see this epsilon of M is really small. Even in dimension M equals 2, it's on the vicinity, I think, of 0.00, maybe another 0, but then in the 1. And it's pretty small. That's even dimension 2. And when dimension is higher than 2, it's tiny. So I should think that somehow you can get this 1.8 to improve this considerably. But I don't know how to do it. Right. Okay, so let me give a sketch of how to prove this. The part of dynamics that it uses is the invariant section theorem, which tells you how to find a smooth invariant section for a fiber-preserving map of a fiber bundle, blah, blah, blah. It tells you how to get something like that and prove that it's smooth. The usual hypothesis for it is you have this kind of picture. The vertical lines are squeezed at a certain rate. The base is moved at a certain rate. The map is a certain amount of differentiability. And the conclusion is that you have a unique invariant curve like this red curve, and it has a certain degree of differentiability. So that's what the invariant section theorem is about. Now, here is how it gets involved here. By assumption, so I'm going to prove this part here, Karen's wife it. So I'm assuming that n is continuous. And transverse. No, I'm not going to state it more precisely. That would take a long time to state it quite precisely. The point is that you have some kind of a bundle. The fibers are contracted. You wish to find a section which is invariant under this contraction, and you wish to prove it's a certain degree of smoothness. So, for instance, if the base map is the identity map, you're talking about fixed points of a family of contractions, and you want to know how smooth it is. That would be if the base had dimension 1. If the base had dimension 2, well, you'd have a two-parameter family. But not necessarily in this invariant section theorem are the fibers carried into themselves. They could be carried into different fibers. However, in fact, in this case, we won't get quite that much. Anyway, I'm starting with a continuous transverse field. First thing you can do, you can make it Lipschitz without loss of generality. Now, why is that? Answer, when you change something with a C0 small change, you're only going to change the angles by a little bit. And this is already transverse to something with this is a Lipschitz function, so it's got a finite Lipschitz constant. That means that the slopes are never too bad. And that means that if you're looking at lines which are almost vertical, they're still transverse to the graph. Okay? So you can approximate this and still have a continuous transverse field and Lipschitz. Second, a Lipschitz plane field over a Lipschitz submanifold will give a Lipschitz tubular neighborhood. It is a tubular neighborhood, which is Lipschitz. Now, what does that mean? It means that you have gotten a submanifold and you've got all these planes which depend in a Lipschitz fashion on the point in the submanifold, and at different points the planes don't cross within a certain distance away from the submanifold. Furthermore, that if you just looked at, if you imagined that this was straight, i.e. looked at N, P, perp, and said, okay, map the neighborhood of this to the, it's easier to say it in coordinates, but anyway, that there is a mapping from the product, locally. There's a mapping from the product of the m-dimensional disk with the n minus m-dimensional disk to this neighborhood of the submanifold in Euclidean space, such that the map is Lipschitz, such that the plane, the disks here are carried into the planes through the point, and such that there is a lower bound for how much points get mapped close together. according to how far apart they are in the domain. That means by Lipschitz. Lipschitz with a Lipschitz inverse. So that's a tubular neighborhood described locally. Okay. It's not hard to prove this. It's a matter of, the real question is, how, the question is this. If you have two points which are close together, and you know that the angle is varying in a Lipschitz fashion, what is the distance where these two lines can meet? And if it's varying in a Lipschitz fashion, you will see that that this intersection cannot occur arbitrarily close to the green line. Okay, that's just high school geometry, but unpleasant when the lines are not straight and not horizontal and so forth. Okay, so that shows that you have a Lipschitz tubular neighborhood. So therefore you have a projection from that neighborhood. Let's call this neighborhood U. Okay, this merely takes each of these fibers here and pushes all of it to the point where it meets the submanifold. So this is the tubular neighborhood retraction. Okay, now, here's what you do next. You form, well, you notice that, let me actually call this NR. So this is the radius R. So it's some small radius. Okay, now, this, of course, is Lipschitz, but nothing better. Now, suppose that you take the map and you approximate it. Convolution approximated. So that means you average its values locally using a C-infinity bump function. And you call that map F. Okay, so what this is doing is the following. This is a standard maneuver in Euclidean space. You define fx as the integral, average value, of beta of, say, y, let's say epsilon y, times f at x plus epsilon y. Now, I put the epsilon in the wrong place, as usual, where beta is a bump function, and the y is an n-dimensional variable, the big space, and integral of beta is 1. So what you're doing here, as y is varying, so this is when y is less than or equal to 1, and so your space, I'm trying to draw the graph of a bump function. So this is Rn, the big space, beta's real-valued function, non-negative. The integral of it is 1. So what you're doing in this formula is you're taking the average of the values of f at points which are close to x. This is a C-infinity function, and it C0 approximates pi. I wrote F. Sorry about that. But I mean to take pi. In other words, the projection. I'm averaging the projection. Averaging the values of the projection over nearby points, and I'm calling that F. So this is usually pi sub epsilon. Just means the epsilon approximation to pi. So I'm going to let epsilon be super small. And also, these neighborhoods be small. And I'm going to claim I get the following features for pi epsilon. Which mimic features for pi. So I can look at df, and I can think of the coordinates here, the np and the np perp. I call this the capital X coordinate, and that the capital Y coordinate. Of course, I've got this kind of XY coordinate system at a whole bunch of charts, at a whole bunch of points, just looking at one. I want to write this with respect to the XY chart. All right, where? So this is at a point Q, which is close to the point P. Okay, and so that means that A will be mapping X to X. C will be mapping X to Y. B will be mapping Y to X. And K will be mapping Y to Y. Now, suppose for a moment that pi equaled F and P equaled Q, right? Sort of the ideal case. In that case, A would be the identity, because you're projecting straight down onto the green. And imagine also that the green thing is horizontal. So that's the perfect case. K for pi would be 0. It completely crushes the vertical direction. And likewise, these two, B would be 0 and C would be 0. All right. Now, in the actual case, what you have is this, that A is equal to the identity plus little o 1. Now, let's see, I want to get make sure I've got this little o 1 is correct. This is as epsilon tends to 0. And Q is very close to P. Yes. So this is as epsilon tends to 0 and Q minus P tends to 0. A is this. B is small. C is bounded. And K is small. Now, this is not crazy, because essentially, F, being averages of the values of pi, is going to have properties which are similar to pi. It's going to pretty hardly, it's going to crush things in the vertical direction. It's not going to do much in the horizontal direction. Now, the C, I'll just say something about, the B refers to in a sense, how much the fibers, the verticals, are not being conserved, are being sent to other things. But the fibers are getting so crushed, so hard, that even though they're not sent very vertically, the effect on them is small. Okay, so this is less easy to believe, but it's true. Finally, this thing about C. What does C represent? C represents the shear. That means how much the fibers are pushed up and down by this map. The shear, like this way, the vertical shear. Now, that is largely introduced just from the fact that you're projecting to something which is Lipschitz and not straight across. It has to do, this C has to do, it's basically equal to the Lipschitz constant of the function G. Okay, so this is some messy analysis to prove this. But I'm going to assume that this is true. I'll assume some other things, too. So let's look at the space of sections of the bundle N, or the disks of radius R in it. So these are maps which send M into NR such that pi composed with sigma of X is X for all X. So these are mappings from, and this red curve indicates the image of one of these sections. So a section will take a general point X and it will map it somewhere into the fiber over it. Okay? That's a section. A priori, nothing. Okay, but we're interested in Lipschitz sections. Assume that the Lipschitz constant of the section is less than or equal to twice the Lipschitz constant of any one of these g's, some reasonable bound. Okay, so it's some reasonable kind of section. Consider what F does to it. So you look at sigma of M. That's a subset like this red one. No, the green one is also an example. That's the zero section. You say, okay, look at the section. Apply F. Claim, this is again a section. That takes proof. The new section is called F sharp for the induced by F section. So this is a map from the section, Lipschitz sections, to, in fact, this will again be Lipschitz with the same Lipschitz constant using all of these smallnesses. Epsilon very small. New section, also Lipschitz. This Lipschitz constant, i.e. the slope of the thing, less than or equal to the same thing as before. Now, what you're doing then is you're mapping this space into itself in a natural way. It says, take a section, some kind of a subset of the normal bundle, apply F to it. It's obviously a subset of the normal bundle much closer to the zero section. You get a claim, you get a new section. Claim, you haven't messed the Lipschitz constant up. Furthermore, this contracts. Now, what the natural norm to put on sections is a sup norm. That is the supremum of the differences between two sections. You got section number one, and you got section number two. For each x, these are just points in the same plane. So you can take the length of that vector in the plane, sigma 1x minus sigma 2x, and take the supremum as x varies in the submanifold. That's a natural norm to put on this space. Theorem, the space is complete with respect to that norm. Proof, if you've got a sequence of Lipschitz functions with a fixed Lipschitz constant, and they're converging uniformly to a limit, which is what this norm gives you, then the limit has the same Lipschitz constant. The Lipschitz constants don't blow up under uniform convergence. Okay, so you say this is a contraction, complete metric space, has a unique unique fixed point, which means it's a unique invariant section. So invariant under F means that you take this section, you look at the image, and then you've got that image in mind, and you apply F to the image, get the same point set. That's what it means to have an invariant section geometrically. Okay, so you get that. Claim that it's of class C1. How to prove this? The proof is, by the way, all of this stuff here that I've been talking about, this is the guts of the invariant section theorem, as in the book by Mohersh, me, and Mike Shube. Likewise, this part of the proof is either in the book or ought to be. It says this. Suppose you got a Lipschitz function. Now, if you've had analysis, you know that if you have a Lipschitz function, it's got a derivative almost everywhere. And this is a hard theorem.
This is Rademacher's theorem.
Now, what it says in terms of our sigma f is that sigma f is differentiable almost everywhere. And that means that this set has a tangent plane almost everywhere. This is a submanifold of the normal bundle, Lipschitz for sure, and at almost all of its points, it's got a tangent plane. Which means one of these planes having dimension m, to which it's tangent. I mean, tangent plane, literally. That's what Rademacher gives you, because you're talking about graphs. Okay, now you kind of repeat this analysis. You say, well, let's look at fields of planes which are potential tangent plane fields over the whole of this sigma FM. In other words, we're hoping to prove that this does have a continuous tangent bundle. So we want to find a family of planes which is continuous and which is everywhere tangent to it. Well, we've got at least a little bit of a start, but there's nothing to say about the continuity of this at all. So we've got to prove some continuity thing. Well, we say, let's look at all continuous, or not, actually, let's look at all, that's important, all tangent plane fields, potential, all n-plane fields, wrong, m. M-plane fields over sigma FM, which everywhere have slope less than or equal to this Lipschitz constant. All right, so what we're looking at here is our invariant set, sigma FM, and we're imagining a field of planes, not necessarily continuous, but all of a reasonable slope. Okay. Okay, I'm yes at first, but not necessarily. Defined at least at points of an invariant set in the manifold, but possibly on the whole manifold. All right, let's look at them. Let's call script H the set of all M-plane fields. There's a natural action of this, from this to itself, which is induced by the derivative of F. And here's how it's induced. You say, okay, you got a tangent, not a tangent plane, you got a plane of the correct dimension to be a tangent plane at this point, and the slope isn't too bad. All right? You have your map F, which is in fact mapping it to a nearby point. Then you say, well, what would happen to this plane if I applied DF to it? Right? You have the old plane here, and I have the DF image of it. So let's call this old plane, say, capital P. So it's a new plane. Claim. Because of the ABCK properties of the DF, this new plane, it still has a slope less than or equal to the original slope, bound, to the original bound. And furthermore, suppose I had two planes, two different planes, correct dimension, slope not too bad, passing through the same point, and I applied DF to both. The angle between them would get crushed. The reason is K, is so small. And A is approximately 1. C isn't messing things up. B isn't messing things up. The angle between them gets crushed. Conclusion. There is a unique M-plane field invariant under DF. Now, I said DF invariant. Actually, the better thing to call it is tangent to F, TF. TF acts on the tangent bundle. DF acts on a single tangent space. So call it TF invariant. Okay. Two observations. One, the set of continuous M-plane fields is closed in this, and it's invariant by this action, TF. Therefore, the unique invariant section is continuous. That's one thing. But it's better than, yeah? Okay. Look at the set of M-plane fields, which are continuous. They form a subset of all of them, right? I claim they form a closed set. Reason, how are you measuring the distance between two fields? By the soup metric. Continuous functions are closed in the soup metric among all functions. Correct? Okay, so this is continuous automatically. Good. What about if we look at an invariant subset? Now, the invariant subset is this. This sigma f is almost everywhere differentiable. So there is some subset R contained in sigma Fm, R for Rademacher. A full measure, talking Lebesgue measure, dimension M, full measure where the thing has a tangent plane. Suppose that we look at the intersection of Fn R over all n, say greater than or equal to 0. Each of these sets has full measure. Therefore, the intersection has full measure. All right, so let's call this R0. At points of this, you do have a tangent plane, and also you have a tangent plane at all the images. Or is it all the pre-images? Anyway, maybe I'll just do it both ways at once. I'll still get a set of full measure. An invariant. All right. Suppose that I had merely looked at M-plane fields with this slope, which were defined over this invariant set. All right. I would say, well, there's a unique one of a certain slope, which is invariant under TF. Well, the Rademacher tangent plane fields are invariant under TF, and so they must have been it. That shows that this known continuous M-plane field restricts on the set R to the Rademacher plane field. So that's by uniqueness of this fixed point, H, restricted to R. I'll call it the Rademacher derivative, tangent plane derivative, tangent plane. That shows that you have the following wonderful situation. I'll say it in terms of functions. Suppose you had a function which you knew was Lipschitz, so you know that it has a derivative almost everywhere. Suppose that derivative extends to some matrix-valued function defined on your domain, which is continuous. Then your function is of class C1. That's a calculus lemma, which I could prove later on. But it's a nice fact, right? You got the Rademacher derivative for a Lipschitz function. You want to prove that it's C1. All you got to know is that this Rademacher derivative extends to a continuous thing like the derivative is, I see, some matrix. To put it a different way, if the Rademacher derivative is uniformly continuous, then the function is C1. Because uniform continuity implies that it will extend to the closure. Okay, so that's the proof, that's the outline of the proof, that this invariant section is of class C1. It's not nearly as tricky to go from C1 to C infinity. This is the standard result of Whitney. And to go from C infinity to analytic is, again, hard, but I have no knowledge or interest in that. Okay, now, so this is a sketch of the proof. I want to make some remarks about 0.018, or 0.18. Any comments or on this part of it? Well, yes, because it's F is smooth. No, this is local. This is local by local by local. This is not intended to move the point P. But if you did move the point P, it would be. This is intended to be a local analysis. Remember, F is not far from the identity. It's not moving points very far. So you're really working inside coordinate systems. You're not really going from one coordinate system to a distant coordinate system. But to answer your question, if capital N is continuous, and we are using, as the point varies, we're always using the transverse field capital N, then the splitting will be continuous, the splitting of the space. F will be smooth, and so its partial matrices will be continuous functions. Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, what about this other part? Oh. Let's see. You would have to redo things, I think, because now you've proved that you've got a submanifold, which is C1. Then you'd have to find a normal bundle for it, which you could basically reuse the old normal bundle. But you'd have to make it C1. Well, it was C infinity before, basic. Okay, right. To get the section to be very smooth, it's an issue of contraction rate in the fiber versus contraction rate in the base, and you do have a little bit of contraction in the base, because the map A is close to the identity but not equal to it. Yes, along the invariant section. Well, because of the averaging of F, and because this isn't really a straight line. I agree it's close. You could probably squeeze out a CR theorem. But these estimates were annoying enough. Now, what about this other thing? Suppose that you've got a situation here where the slope of each of these G's, local expressions for the submanifold, are always less than or equal to some constant, which, as I said, turns out to be this. Okay, suppose that's true. What you wish to do, so you say, suppose the manifold can be covered in these XY type of charts, X perpendicular to Y. And in it, the manifold looks like graphs of a function, and the Lipschitz constant of the functions always less than some constant. What do you have to do to find a continuous plane field from this data? You have to be able to average planes. And keep transversality. So you could think of the situation as where you've got here. This is one coordinate system, and you have another coordinate system, where again, in that coordinate system, the slope looks okay. So the slope, okay. What you want to do is you want to be able to average these normals. In such a way that you keep transversality. So that's an issue of finding a centroid in the Grossmann space of m-dimensional planes in n space. Meaning that you wish to be given a certain number of planes with weights attached to them. The weights will come from a bunch from a partition of unity. And then you wish to be able to define, in a continuous way, to define a centroid of, so I'll call it P1 with weight 1, etc., PK with weight K. The sum of the weights adds up to 1, the weights are greater than or equal to 0, and the planes that you're trying to average, they are all in some kind of a sector around a basic plane. Then the question will be, can you do it? And a long time ago, I was figuring out a proof of Cheeger finiteness theorem, and a centroid construction came up in that, which works here. But it works with this funny hypothesis that all the planes have to be in a sector of this slope, wherever that slope was, 0.18. They have to be in a sector in order that the average of them also be contained in a reasonable size sector. You see, what would be bad here is if when you averaged two planes that it became not transverse anymore. So you're fighting against the slope of the of the graph. Anyway, so I don't have anything more to say about that. It's a centroid construction. If you can find a very good centroid construction, you will be able to improve this number. But the result of Sullivan and Curvair, that shows that there does exist a number, and it will be greater than 0.18. There exists B, a barrier to smoothability. And it means this. If you have a topological manifold which is not smoothable, but it is Lipschitz, then you can try to embed it into Euclidean space as best you can. You will never find an embedding where it locally appears to have, it locally appears as the graph with a Lipschitz constant less than or equal to B. If it's not smoothable, there will be bound to be some points with bad Lipschitz behavior. And just what that B is, I don't know, except that it's greater than that number. Okay, so that's enough. Well, again, there I think, I'm not sure, but the if you take one of his seven spheres, well, it's already smooth. What do you mean?
Okay.
You take it, and you say, well, locally Lipschitz,
okay, so I get
and you just get back the same thing. Oh, I see what you're asking. No. You're correct.
Yeah, I'm probably
wrong. No. This is a good question. Now I get it. You say, suppose that your manifold was already smooth. Okay, so it's certainly Lipschitz. And you get this new manifold, which the new manifold, this red one here, is lipiomorphic to the original one just by going along the fibers, because the tubular neighborhood is Lipschitz. What if you started with the green one already smooth? You would find a, You would find directly a lipiomorphism But in fact, you could have said, well, you happen to choose this as a Lipschitz tubular neighborhood, but if you had a smooth submanifold, you were silly not to choose a smooth tubular neighborhood, and then you would get a diffeo from one to the other. So there are other seven spheres, true, but they won't be close to this one in this embedded sense. Now, what they'll be close to, I don't know. I mean, you're kind of asking, how do they look, these other seven spheres? I only know this. They don't. The ordinary seven sphere, of course, embeds in one higher dimension, but the other guys don't. It takes higher dimensions to put them in. Yeah, right. That's true too. I don't know if that's always true for different, like if the normal bundle exactly classifies the smooth structure. But Yeah, a Lipiotopy. Right. Yeah. Right. Suppose. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you know, of course, that there are two different smooth structures. Great. So you take these two different smooth spheres and you say, are they Lipiotopic? Prove or disprove? Then they what? Yeah, they may be smoothly isotopic, in other words. But that's a nice question. Does Lipiotopy... Right, you could try. Yeah, and you're going to have difficulties if you've got two different things on the opposite ends, but maybe you can do it, especially if you have enough dimensions. Anyhow, yeah, I think there's plenty of Lipschitz type of questions which are hard to do and fun. Yeah, it tries to get smooth. Yeah, that's a nice idea. I mean, it's kind of like instead of smoothing the retraction, you smooth the object itself. It wants to get smooth. I wonder how you would do that. Well, I mean, it's in Euclidean space. Yeah. Well, yeah, but I like that idea. It's like the manifold itself is trying to help you. Yeah. Yes, it's a bit tricky. The F is weird. Correct. Right. Well, here's how it would not be a new section. The original thing looks like this. The new one looks like that. That's the kind of bad possibility, right? Okay. It avoids that. You avoid it. This doesn't happen. This is bad enough. And the issue is this. Suppose that you look at the map. Let's see. You first go up by sigma, over by F, and down by pi, that this map should be 1-to-1. That prohibits that, basically. Now, why is this true? Okay, you go up, you go over, okay. Oh, basically, the reason that this is true is that what you're looking at here is more or less like A, the first part, and A is the identity. And that kind of controls this not happening. Yeah, but there's things to prove.
Correct.
Yeah, well, I mean, the invariant section theorem is not a triviality. It's the same kind of issue. Yeah, enough.